You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of January 2018 on Monocle 24. Live from London, this is Midori House. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up, the decline of democracy in Brazil. Is this the end of the line for Lula? And meanwhile in Israel?
Jerusalem has been the capital of the Jewish people for 3,000 years. It's been the capital of Israel for nearly 70 years. It was here that our temple stood, our kings ruled, our prophets preached.
Diplomacy between the United States and Israel is now cozier than ever. But is it a doomed love affair? My guests, Isabel Hilton and Daniela Peled, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including an extraordinary investigation by the Financial Times reveals the severity of sexual misconduct in London's halls of high power, and why a fall in book sales has got publishers pondering whether we've all lost our funny bone. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Daniela Peled, Managing Editor of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and Isabel Hilton, Editor of China Dialogue. And welcome both to the programme. Now, is this how democracy potentially ends? Well, that's the question many bewildered Brazilians will be asking themselves today as the nation's former president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, or simply Lula, waits to find out whether he'll be imprisoned after being found guilty of corruption charges. And that, we must say that, the question what's going to happen in this case is being heard as we are now, and we will bring you any kind of updates on it. Now, the concern here, I think, for many supporters, Daniela, is that they feel this is a bit of a politicised process, and also if he's got out of the way, that the people waiting in the wings to potentially be the new president, some of them are not that savoury. But what do you take, first of all, of Lula, his years in power, and how he's being judged now?
Well, it's very unusual that somebody leaves two terms of office with a popularity rating of, I think, 80%. And I think there's a certain amount of rose-tinted looking back on his tenure, because Brazil really did change during those years. But I think what I find striking about this whole situation is how divided the country is, and how many people, the proportion of people saying they would not vote for him under any circumstances, and the proportion of people saying that they definitely will vote for him under any circumstances is really astonishing. And the tensions over this the judges sitting, where you've got the army deployed, and you've got sharpshooters on roofs, and you've got people extremely, extremely tense. What will happen? I mean, it seems somewhat of a lose-lose situation, because whichever way the decision goes today, it's going to leave a lot of people extremely angry.
And he, we must say, says that he did nothing wrong. And we, in fact, Monica, the only interview that he's done with foreign press in recent months, about 6-7 weeks ago, and there he was saying, I'm looking forward to this because it's going to prove and I did nothing wrong, exonerate me. You look less convinced potentially as well. But what's your read of that? Because, again, as Daniel was saying, what's interesting is that he did leave on this high, and he did change the lives of many Brazilians. And while we have this huge corruption scandal going on, you wonder if some of it is touching him just because that is how business had been done just for so long in Brazil.
Well, that may well be true. We should also remember that in 2013, pretty much the entire inner circle of the PT was done for corruption. That was before the coup. So it's not that the PT, Lula's party, was not corrupt. Lula was absolutely transformative, and he was, in fact, still is, one of the more serious and responsible politicians that Brazil has ever produced. The trial itself, I have no idea if he took money, but the trial fell well short of what you might call the highest standards of the judiciary. He was eventually convicted on something he hadn't been charged with. The evidence against him, such as it was the result of a plea bargain for somebody who had confessed to corruption from one of the companies that were allegedly paying Lula off. So the evidence was pretty slender. He remains popular. Were he to be able to run for president again in the autumn, he would almost certainly win. In contrast to Michel Temer, the current president, who became president after the coup against Dilma, who enjoys a popularity rating of 3%. So this is indeed a deeply troubled country. I have to say, it's not the first time that Brazilian democracy has faced challenges. As we know, it had a military dictatorship. It's had endless corruption scandals, including the impeachment of one president on corruption. It's pretty endemic. But the coup against Dilma, who was the chosen successor to Lula, was almost certainly engineered to avoid corruption charges or to get control of this corruption this corruption investigation, so that Temer and his cronies would not go down on corruption charges. Temer, the current president, has only avoided corruption charges through a political maneuver. And so, you know, nobody is coming out of this with any credit, and Brazilians are pretty much in despair.
Daniela, you know, both you and Isabel have worked and covered and seen many countries where this kind of corruption runs in every direction. For Brazil, it's a huge issue because you can't quite see where the generation of politicians is that will be untouched by this. This car wash scandal was about, you know, payments which started with, you know, Petrobras, the oil company. But it soon unfolded that, you know, there was a way of doing politics and business that always involved a little bit of money here and there to kind of grease the wheels. Huge sums at the top, but even at the very kind of lowest level, there was just a network of money, of patronage that was seen as actually not that wrong.
I think that is the real problem. All the countries that top the corruption indexes, places like Afghanistan, for instance, you have massive corruption at the top, but it does trickle down into everyday life and it just becomes a normal way of doing things. If you want to access services, for instance, if you want to get a passport, if you want to access basic legal processes, you have to pay money. It affects every level. Whereas, I mean, here, I wouldn't say that Britain was not particularly, there has its problems with corruption, but so the idea of offering a bribe to a policeman on the street is just ludicrous. Corruption has a different level. And there's also something very dangerous about, and we've seen it here in the UK too, when the general public just dismisses the entire public sphere in officialdom as corrupt, and they're all as bad as each other and they're all corrupt. I think that's very problematic. It makes people vulnerable to going for really just distinctive personalities and people who've got the charisma to carry the people with them. And I wonder whether this is the case slightly with Lula as well. He still enjoys that personal touch. He still has that amazing popularity, which I personally find, in any political context, I find that a bit worrying.
And just before we move on, in the China context, you know, the huge amount of work trying to be done to stop corruption, well, that's what we read anyway. But again, that same process of patronage, do you think even when you see those grand campaigns there that it is being unpicked, that there is a change in how that's done? Or is that, you know, the passing on of small bribes here and there to get things done just part of the system?
There are theorists of corruption who argue that in countries where systems don't function very well, corruption up to around 10-15% is a positive thing because it allows people to get things done. It access services, it gets permissions, it does all that. When it goes above that, it becomes a burden. It's rent-seeking on a major scale and it becomes a burden on the economy. But there are other aspects to it. You know, the accumulation of wealth at the top, which we've seen not just in China or Brazil, but increasingly in the United States and here, you know, which means that public servants are paid less well, and it becomes, you know, you do, they tend to begin to use the power that they have to offer obstructions in order to do rent seeking. In China, the anti-corruption drive was largely an effort to improve the image of the Communist Party, but also on the part of Xi Jinping to remove obstacles to his consolidation of power. So he managed to get rid of an awful lot of enemies.
And do you think the culture changed or has changed in recent years?
Up to a point, yes. I mean, I think the culture change of conspicuous high living at all levels, that is now too dangerous in China. But the problem with China is that if the Communist Party retains control of all the levers of power, there will be corruption. It doesn't have independent courts, it doesn't have independent police, it doesn't have an independent press. You know, so of course there will be corruption within the party. It's a matter of who's in and who's out, really. You know, it's a bit like the mafia. When someone goes down, when a mafia member goes down, you don't ask, you know, was he a criminal? You ask, how did he lose his protection? And the Chinese anti-corruption campaign is a bit like that, because corruption was so pervasive that the question you ask is, what faction was he in? You know, whose enemy was he? How did he lose his protection? And what's the political meaning of that particular corruption charge?
Well, we're going to change locations now. We're going to Israel now, where, as one Israeli diplomat quipped, a visit from US Vice President Mike Pence was supposed to be a Seinfeld visit. That is, a visit about nothing. In fact, it gave many hints as to how the Trump administration views Israel and its geopolitical standing. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu referred to the vice president as Mike, and there were plenty of friendly backslaps on display for the press. And then when it came to review the vice president's speech, one columnist writing for Haaretz called it an unabashedly Zionist sermon. Daniela, how big is this connection, this love affair between DC and Jerusalem these days?
Well, first of all, I mean, I wouldn't overstate it. There's the personal relationship between Netanyahu and Obama was pretty bad, unsurprisingly. But Trump is not an unalloyed success as well, because he's ultimately unpredictable and has no clear strategy. And I think the look on Netanyahu's face during Trump's visit, when Trump said, well, one state, two state, you know, whatever works for you guys, and basically turned his back on decades of American policy, you know, spoke volumes. So the Pence visit in Israel has received massive press coverage. But I think its significance is more that across the spectrum of Israeli political thought, right and left, there is a feeling that the world is against us. No one likes us. We don't care. Even the left wing in Israel thinks, yeah, but the world and the UN and the European Union are being a bit unfair. They are singling us out too much. So this kind of visit, this massive support and I love you guys and this massive bromance between him and Netanyahu, it does cheer Israelis a little bit. It stops them thinking that actually the evangelical view of Israel and the Holy Land and the ingathering of the exiles and the end of days and what will actually happen when all the Jews come back to Jerusalem is a little bit apocalyptic and not in any kind of good way for a Jewish state in Israel. So I think right now people are basking in the attention, really, in the fact that this the second most powerful man in the world really seems to love them. And that is enough for now.
Yes, but why do we think that Donald Trump, a man that isn't that concerned about foreign politics in many ways, isn't certainly somebody who cares about, you know, people of other faiths or any of these issues. Why is the Israel question and what happens to the Jewish state so important to him, do you think?
Well, I think it's not terribly important in the outcome, but supporting Israel is important because it plays well with the evangelicals, who are an important part of Trump's domestic political support. And, you know, Mike Pence is one of them. And that vision, the evangelical, you know, absolutely core sympathy for Israel in apocalyptic terms, is something that Trump, I think, thinks he can play to. And I think that he doesn't really have a very clear sense of what the consequences are. I mean, the fact that he doesn't have a plan for the Middle East means that he's left it essentially to Jared Kushner and to Pence. And that is extraordinarily dangerous. And if you look at the alarm that's being felt, for example, in Jordan right now, you can see how at least you know, the more vulnerable countries in the neighbourhood are taking this very seriously indeed, and they're not terribly thrilled. You know, Jordan is Jordan, you know, the king, of course, is, you know, the guardian of the holy places in Jerusalem. And he sits in a country that has no oil, no water, and is divided between a large Palestinian population and a tribal Arab population. And Jordan's tremendous fear has always been that Israel would expel Palestinians into Jordan, and that would, you know, become, that would completely destabilize Jordan. And I think that all the moves that have been made by the Trump administration so far have raised the level of alarm considerably.
I mean, to talk at the beginning, you know, is this a kind of slightly doomed relationship? Do you think that they have enough common ground to, you know, stay the course over the next few years, and, you know, that Trump will be able to get some discussion going on about peace within the region? Or do you think that that is just never going to happen now?
That's a very, very simple answer, which a very, very short word, which is no. Look, the Netanyahu aim at the moment is to maintain the status quo. I mean, they're fairly open about it as well. And that, as I said, that does have a certain amount of resonance across the Israeli political spectrum. The idea that there's no solution, there's no partner for peace. We just have to sort of do the best we can until a new leadership emerges. Maybe facts on the ground will be different, give the Palestinians a little bit of autonomy. That's pretty popular. And it's also important to remember that Netanyahu, who heads the most right-wing government in Israel's history, is actually fairly moderate on those the government's terms. He's not on the left of the government, but he's certainly a centrist. And you look at the other people in his government and the people who are likely to replace him. So the relationship between Jerusalem and Washington has to be strong for all kinds of reasons, beyond personal interests and personalities. But
so are you saying that, you know, I know what you're going to say, but do you believe that this is an administration, a US administration, who absolutely has no interest in getting peace within the region?
Well, I think that's obvious. I mean, I think that's obvious to everyone. But more importantly, I think the longer term consequences is this: over this administration and through Netanyahu's efforts, Israel's become a much more bipartisan issue in America. It used to be equally supported, Republicans, Democrats, and that's really, really changed. And also, American Jewish support for Israel is also wavering as a result of policies of the Israeli government. So I think the next American administration will really see the consequences of that.
Do you think that Obama's policies were good then? Because, you know, he played this tough hand with Israel and said, you know, we need to push this two-state solution. We need you to come to the table. We're not going to do everything you want. We're going to criticize you for things that we think are against the spirit of the agreement we're trying to reach. But, you know, everyone in the end said actually it was not that successful either. You know, is this one of those situations where it's not a time when peace could be delivered, or was Obama on a better tack trying to push for a two-state solution?
Well, personally, I think Obama was on a better tack in that there was at least a possibility that that might advance. He didn't give it a whole lot of attention, to be fair, but he was also instrumental in the Iranian deal, which is another thing that looks extremely vulnerable under Trump. And the fact is that the wider Middle East is being remade almost without US participation. You know, the forces that are at work redrawing the many maps in the Middle East beyond Israel-Palestine, the United States is hardly there at all. We're looking at Iran, we're looking at Russia. You know, these are not, we're looking at the Saudis. These are forces that the United States seems simply to have turned its back on. And so the overall loss of influence of the United States, you know, in the Middle East as in other theatres, is pretty remarkable for a one-year president.
Daniel, one side story in this was this strange optics about female journalists not being able to be present at all times or being segregated, who are in the US press corps. Now, when we had the election campaign, Donald Trump, you know, hit out a Muslim man whose wife did stand beside him while he made a speech, the father of a veteran. And he said, you know, he hinted that, you know, men and women should never appear like that, but they had to kind of be able to kind of both be expressing their views. It turned out it was a much different story. He hit at the optics of a Muslim couple, not seeming about the world of equality. Here, the administration went along with this idea that, women and men shouldn't be together, they should be segregated, which they wouldn't allow back at home. They would have gone crazy about it. Do they need to be a bit more careful about those optics, how those things play back at home?
I'm not sure anyone really minded. I think they bought into that whole idea that the Western Wall is basically an open-air synagogue and the most holy place for all the Jewish people. And that's what you do. You have men and women sitting separately. Well, that's true in an Orthodox synagogue. That's not true in all synagogues. And certainly it wasn't actually functioning as a synagogue because it was completely closed. And it was only Mr. Pence and his wife, I think, who were there. And nothing to stop evangelical Christians praying together at the wall. No, look, the part of the Israeli political landscape is that the ultra-Orthodox have an enormous amount of political power and they have virtual hegemony over areas like the Western Wall. And it does slightly show how ludicrous the idea is that Jerusalem is the eternal, undivided capital of all the Jewish people when you have a situation where it's basically owned by the small group of Orthodox Jews at that particular area. It's a very... I wouldn't particularly recommend it as a place to visit, since it seems to have been stripped of all spirituality. And I think a lot of Israeli Jews, secular, even religious ones, would agree with me.
Well, you're listening to Midori House. Here with me, Andrew Tuck, Daniela Pellard and Isabel Hilton. Coming up next, how an extraordinary article in the Financial Times exposes the severity of sexual misconduct in the halls of high power. And we'll also find out why a drop in sales has got booksellers looking for ways to turn their frowns upside down. Stay tuned.
Pack your bags and join us on a global tour through exciting and inspiring cities. From Madrid to Miami, Tokyo to Toronto, we've created travel guides that will help you get the best out of a city, no matter how short your stay. We'll whirl you around some of our favorite architectural spots, top cultural haunts, and then point you in the direction of a well-earned drink from a little-known cocktail bar. We've also scouted the prettiest running routes, the most design-savvy shops, and the best hotels to comfortably rest your head. View our full range of travel guides at monocle.com or visit any good bookstore and plan your next escape today. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
You're back with Midori House. I'm Andrew Tuck, and still with me are Isabel Hilton and Daniela Pellard. An auction catalogue distributed to attendees of an exclusive charity fundraiser here in London included various images of Marilyn Monroe. Lots included a night at Soho's Windmill Strip Club and some plastic surgery with an invitation to add spice to your wife. This might sound like the average Playboy party of the 1960s. In fact, it took place at the Dorchester here in London last Thursday, and many of the terrible details recorded by two undercover reporters for the Financial Times hint that this is a world that has not been broken by recent scandals. So this is an extraordinary event, and it raises a huge amount of money for charity and is seen as a bit of a lad's night out, Isabel, for all sorts of people who are extremely wealthy. But it feels like something from a terrible time that I think we all thought had disappeared. Who knew that these events even took place anymore?
Absolutely. Reading it sort of had the flavour of a working man's club in, Yorkshire in the 1960s, honestly, where boys will be boys kind of thing. And hats off to the FT and the two women who signed up with their black underwear to do this, because otherwise we would not have known. These are rich and powerful people. The staff had to sign non-disclosure agreements. Their mobile phones were taken away. It was clearly, this has been running for years in this vein, with the intention that nobody ever finds out about it. And now that we have found out about it, the extent of kind of public revulsion is pretty encouraging. Yes, it raises a lot of money for charity, but Great Ormond Street, the children's hospital that was to be a major beneficiary, has said, no, thank you. We really don't want money that's raised like this. And the whole series, the Charities Commission, is now investigating them. People are running for the hills, trying to distance themselves. The person who led the charity, a man called David Mellor, has been booted off a position that he held in the Department of Education, because clearly Theresa May is not very pleased at this. So the extent to which the reaction has been extremely decided is encouraging. I still find it pretty shocking that this culture should have persisted quite so long, and that despite all the events of last year, these men thought they would get away with it.
It's interesting. So just for people who haven't read the story, it says the uniform requirements were detailed. All hostesses should bring black sexy shoes, black underwear, and do their hair and makeup as they would go to a smart, sexy place.
It's pretty cliched stuff, isn't it? I mean, they don't get out enough, clearly.
It's all just a bit grubby. Dresses and belts would be supplied on the day. Daniela, I think what's interesting, as Isabel says, is the speed at which people have moved to distance themselves. In the past, people would say, well, we need to have a, you know, have a look and see what went on and have a discussion. And there would have been a sense of protection around people. But now, I don't know, the post Harvey Weinstein, it just feels that people do move very quickly to try and shut these things down.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it might have been a different reaction had this taken place 6 months or a year ago. I'm not sure that there would have been such backing for this proper piece of journalism as well, which has been, which is, you know, the judgment might have been, well, that's what happens. We do accept these things as part of, I'm sure Isabel and I have seen lots of rather awful behaviour, you know,
indeed,
in government circles, in foreign policy circles. What I find kind of amusing about this whole thing is how many people happen to have left early, how many guests left early and didn't see anything. That's strange, really. But I'm also bracing myself for a backlash to the backlash. And I've already seen all kinds of chatter on social media with people saying, well, you know, these waitresses knew what they were in for. You know, well, they were probably excited about meeting these powerful men, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that attitude does have a fair amount of play still in the mainstream, and I think we'll see a bit of that coming up in the right wing press in the future. It is strange that you can explicitly call for a male only event, and I think there are some legal issues around that, apart from some social niceties there.
And yeah, and then, you know, the description that you give to the women who come to serve at these things, as it were, that's the bit that makes it all clear from the outset that this is not going to be a kind of straightforward, pleasant evening.
That is true. And there was the after party. I think a lot of the detail in the Financial Times report is really telling. So there was the dinner, and then there was an after party at which the waitresses were encouraged to drink, at which, you know, they were reporting the propositions, you know, come and join me in the bedroom and all that kind of thing, as well as the, you know, the physical, the groping and the kind of general unpleasantness. And to the degree that you could accuse them of complicity, I mean, I think you have to set against that, again, the description of security, of bouncers being posted outside the ladies' lavatory, timing the women who were going in and out in case they were trying to hide from the experience outside. You know, they were being, they were monitoring the room to make sure that they weren't hanging back from socialising with these men. There was a lot of coercive behaviour on the part of the management, you know, as the night wore on. And I don't think that anyone would feel comfortable with that.
Well, there's bound to be more repercussions, I think, in the days ahead. And finally, though, tonight, we just want to jump in with a short story, which is, according to a book retailer here in the UK, W.H. Smith, if grey clouds really are going to clear up, authors aren't yet putting on a happy face. Because after a rush to explain the sudden and rather serious political reality of 2016, a recent fall in book sales is being blamed on a curious lack of humorous reads. I think you know, Donald Trump's books, you know, books about Donald Trump rather, have done rather well, Fire and Fury, but not enough kind of humour when you go to the bookshop. What do you look? Do you look for escapism, Daniel, when you go? Are you looking for, you know, I'm not quite sure. I see you as a big chit lit client, but potentially
you might be right. You might be right. I mean, I generally try to avoid W.H. Smith in general. It's really not a very exciting or attractive place to browse or look for books, and its range is not wonderful either. No, I think people haven't lost their sense of humour, but we do go for sort of maybe 15-second clips on YouTube rather than a full-length satirical novel.
Yeah, and they're saying there's just not enough funny books. You know, there's so many kind of earnest books about, you know, finance and politics that we're being put off.
It could be that the humorous writers are as depressed as the rest of us by the state of the world, and who can blame them?
Well, that brings us to the end of today's show. Isabel Hilton and Daniela Peled, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House. Today's show was produced by Ben Ryland, was researched by Marcus Hippie and by Katia Mendoza, and our studio manager was Christy Evans. There's more music next, but don't forget to stick around for The Daily at 2200 hours. Midori House back tomorrow. For me, Andrew Tuck, goodbye.